Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. I had a thought about a quick deviation from our announced topic. Our guest, Dr. Stephen Bryan, is well able to talk about cell phones and pagers, and you might want to ask him about them. But we're sticking with Ukraine, which is important for many reasons, not the least of which is that it involves NATO, and NATO involves us. So the potential for large-scale American involvement always looms there. And any changes in the war in Ukraine that brings changes to the relationships inside of NATO will have major ramifications for U.S. foreign and defense policy and U.S. military readiness and the U.S. budget, both the defense budget and as a general expense. So we're more than 20 years past the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. How did we get here? And where are we going? Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022 after a series of demands and counter-demands among Moscow, Kiev, Washington, and several European countries. The U.S. has since provided Ukraine with weapons, a lot of money and weapon support, and political support that included an invitation to address a session of Congress, where, by the way, everybody showed up. At one time, the battles were front page news. Now they're not. They're not even page 7. They're not even page 12. They're not there. So today we're going to go back and talk about how we got here and what's going on and where we might be headed. Quick introduction of the JPC and then on to our guest. The JPC was founded in 1985 to provide perspectives and analysis of foreign and domestic policies by scholars, academics, and commentators. You can find us on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. You can see our Insight articles and our magazine, In Focus, quarterly. The summer issue of In Focus is up right now. It's the domestic issue, and the fall issue, taking a look around our world, will be there shortly. But I also want to suggest that you go back and take a look at winter and spring 2024 for issues important to the American Jewish community and Israel's security following October 7th. And I'll take this opportunity to invite you on October 8th to hear Avi Meir as he talks about this past very difficult year in Israel. You'll get your invitations. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Since October 7th, our most important job is to support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And now more than ever, we support the government of Israel and the IDF in their defense of the people of Israel and in bringing Hamas and Hezbollah to justice, whatever justice is, however you define justice, and making Hamas and its fellow travelers release the hostages. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. And now our guest, Dr. Stephen Bryan. And for those of you who have asked, yes, he is my husband. And yes, he is sitting next to me on his computer. But that's not why he's here. He's here because he is an expert in security, strategy, and technology. If you read his Substack column, Weapons and Strategy, you also know that he's spent an enormous amount of time studying both the Ukrainian and the Russian positions in this war, and also NATO. He's held senior positions in the Department of Defense on Capitol Hill and is president of a large multinational defense and technology community. He was senior staff director of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, served in the Pentagon as deputy undersecretary of defense for trade security policy, and he was the founder and first director of the Defense Technology Security Administration. After his government service, he was president of an Italian technology firm, where a key part of his portfolio was shepherding U.S. and allied cooperation in pursuit of our common defense. So common defense is his theme here. How do the good guys get together? How do they stay together? And how do they protect us? He has twice received the Defense Department's highest civilian award. He presently writes for Asia Times and a variety of other outlets. His books include Technology Security and National Power and Security for Holy Places. And as I said, you can find him on Substack. And now, Stephen Bryan, the floor is yours.
Well, it's a good thing we're married. It gets me the opportunity to to speak to you today. Just a word, I think, to start about Ukraine and the situation there, because I think context is everything here. Shoshana explained to you how the US and our NATO allies are backing the Ukrainians with weapons, but lots of money, including money to support the government itself, salaries, pensions, all that is paid for by either the US or our NATO allies, primarily through the European Union. The war is going badly for the Ukrainians, and by extension, it's going badly for us. The situation is getting really bad as the Russians make critical gains in Donbass, which is where most of the fighting is, and they're reversing the incursion into Kursk, which caused some worry on the Russians' part a couple of weeks back. But right now, I think the overall impression is that there's very little that the Ukrainians can do by themselves to hold off the Russians. What they could do, of course, is make a deal with the Russians, but they're unwilling to do that. And we're reaching a crisis point there. There's pressure now on the NATO allies, and especially on Washington, to authorize deep strikes into Russian territory. But those deep strikes aren't going to change the outcome of the war. I think what they will do is create conditions for overreaction by the Russians and probably the introduction of some form of NATO support in the form of troops or air power or both in the Ukraine conflict. And that means war in Europe as a simple matter. There's no way to avoid it. So we're in a very dangerous time. And it's really interesting that, as Shoshana mentioned, it's not really on the front pages of the US newspapers, or for that matter, even the European ones. But I think the reality is that we're in a real crisis and there's a lot at stake. And that brings me to the broader question of NATO and what's become of NATO and where it's going and how are we obligated in NATO? The truth of the matter is that NATO is a collective security arrangement with now 32 countries. It started with 12, with 32 countries. And the critical provision is called Article 5 of the NATO Treaty. And that's the Collective Defense Treaty. Basically, it says if one of the members is attacked, then the other members are rather obliged to find ways to help reverse that attack by sending in their own forces. And that's essentially the collective security aspect of the NATO alliance. Now, Ukraine is not a member of NATO. It was invited in 2008 to consider joining NATO, but it had to meet certain criteria, which it never met. And so it has never actually become a member, although that offer of membership, as recently as a week or so ago, with Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, saying that Ukraine will become a member of NATO in the future, again reiterating that, but it hasn't happened. The real stumbling block is that since Ukraine is at war with Russia, it's not really possible to join the alliance, since it would oblige everybody to send their troops right into Ukraine. So it's a bluff at the moment. They won't get in, but it's been an offer on the table for a long time. NATO has changed a lot of its direction from the time it was put together in 1949. It was originally an anti-communist alliance trying to, I wouldn't say reverse, but to balance the deals that were cut at the Yalta Conference in 1945 between Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt, which basically conceded most of Eastern Europe to the Russians. But now, of course, Eastern Europe is no longer part of the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union itself no longer exists at all. So the crusade against Russia, if you want to call it that, which NATO is very much doing, is really outside of the original purposes and ideology of the alliance, but it's the new ideology of the current day alliance. In 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the Europeans said, okay, this is a peace dividend. And basically, what they did is almost disarmed completely. They got rid of all their tanks and or almost all of them, all their armored personnel carriers. They downsized the size of their military. They stopped spending on keeping their materials updated and repaired. It was left a mess. It hasn't changed a lot since then. And whatever was in the European arsenals, and this includes also the US, has been dumped into Ukraine, creating a kind of crisis because if there's a conflict elsewhere, we're going to be caught up short without weapons. The big change, there were two. The first was that after 91, NATO became involved in conflicts outside of the NATO alliance. That included Afghanistan, that included Bosnia and Herzegovina, it included Kosovo, it included Libya, and they tried to get it to include Iraq, but the Turks particularly objected, so they created a coalition of the willing, which was NATO without a couple of players. And that again was mainly a political operation because the amount of contribution from Europe into these conflicts was very small because they didn't have much to contribute. But they sent some troops and some airplanes and some tanks to try and make it look good. So from that point of view, NATO is not very well prepared unless it can get support from the United States. The United States has 100,000 troops in Europe right now. That's been augmented by about 20,000 over the historical levels. And we're expected to provide the ground forces, most of the ground forces, for any conflict, including Ukraine, if it comes to that. Now that may be well and good, but the difficulty today is that there are other challenges facing the United States. The Middle East being one, there's a lot going on there, as you well know, especially with Iran, and China, which is a major problem in the Pacific because it's an expanding, strong, militarily strong country. It's economically strong too. And it's a real challenge to Taiwan, to Japan, probably Korea, Philippines, Indonesia. So in those circumstances, a war in Ukraine that actually involved US ground forces could put us in great trouble from the point of view of not having enough ground forces to go elsewhere and not having enough armaments to do our job. So I think that the rise of China is a very significant thing. And we basically, what I would argue, and I'll leave it at that for now, and we can have a conversation. But what I would argue is that given that we have a multipolar threat, not a single polar, but a multipolar threat, we need the Europeans to pick up and do what they need to do if we're going to keep the NATO alliance viable, which means to build up their armies, their air forces, their naval capabilities in such a way that they can be on the front line instead of American soldiers, because we can't support a war in the Pacific and a war in Europe if it came to that, or even a war in Ukraine, because it will stimulate a war in the Pacific. So we just can't support that. We don't have that capability. And it's foolish to think that we do. So I think NATO is on the horns of a dilemma, if you want. I know that former President Trump has talked about larger contributions in terms of finance for NATO forces, but I think from the Europeans. But I think the real trick here is to get them to commit to building their militaries up. Just one little point to make. One of the noisiest countries about promoting war in Ukraine is the British. British are always calling for bombing Russia and doing more to help Zelensky win the war against them, and all this language. Russia, I mean, Britain today, its army is smaller than it was at the time of the American Revolution. And the number of combat soldiers, real combat soldiers, not support, not auxiliary, not logistics, but real combat soldiers is a bit less than 30,000. It's a drop in the bucket. So some people talk a lot, but they don't do a lot. So I'll leave it there. Let's go to questions and see where we are.
Okay. Okay, and we have questions. Took me a second to get back on because we have questions. So you mentioned, we have somebody who asks about this. You mentioned that the US has multiple areas of interest, of military and security interests, the Middle East, Europe, Pacific. What do you think would happen if the US said to the European part of NATO, we can't do it. We can't do it the way we used to do it. You're going to have to do it. And then we pulled back and we increased our forces in the Pacific. What would they do?
They would be very
They'd be upset. I mean, we know they'd be upset, but what would they?
they would be really upset. They're scared now. They're afraid of the spillover of the Ukraine war into Eastern Europe and beyond. There's a lot of uncertainty. If the US ever would say, we're pulling our troops out, we've got to send them to Japan or Taiwan or Korea or someplace like that, I think it would cause a massive European heart attack.
Okay, but could it also induce the Europeans to look for a negotiated settlement in Ukraine instead of arming the Ukrainians?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, everyone's been looking for a settlement, but nobody wants to do it. The British are completely opposed. They're the ones that wrecked the earlier Istanbul deal that was struck between the Ukrainians and the Russians, with the help of the United States, of course. Scholz in Germany says he has a plan, but nobody knows what it is. So that's another problem. Hungary says it has a plan. The Brazilians say they have a plan. The Indians say they have a plan. Everybody has a plan, but nobody wants to do it. My own opinion is that this would be a very good time to try and negotiate with Russia and to open up the dialogue. Maybe it won't go anywhere, but it's absurd not to have a conversation. I think I know what the Russians really want, and I think Washington knows what the Russians really want. They just don't want to give it.
Okay, then the question becomes, we have someone asks, that's all what NATO wants and what America wants. Two parts of the same question. Are there adverse conditions under which Ukraine would want to sue for peace? And are there adverse conditions under which the Russians would want to sue for peace?
Well, given the current situation on the ground in Ukraine, the Russians don't need to sue for peace. They can keep going. But the Ukrainians do. There was an article this past week in the Washington Post by David Ignatius who said the Ukrainians are bleeding out. It means they don't have enough soldiers and they have too many casualties. So there's every reason for Ukraine to want to do a deal, but Zelensky is totally opposed. He has his own peace plan, but he won't say what it was. And he probably won't say until after the elections in the United States. And then it won't be worth anything anyway.
So somebody just jumped in here with a question who is fully supportive of helping Ukraine, he says. But according to you, says the listener, the victory potential for Ukraine is dismal. Could we, should we force Ukraine to negotiate and stop fighting? Can we do that?
That's a good question. I don't know that I have a great answer for it. We haven't tried, that's for sure. Zelensky is opposing it. I think Zelensky's in the way of any potential deal for a couple of reasons. First of all, he said the only deal for Ukraine is total victory. Russians must get out of the entire country. Then the Russian leaders must be tried for war crimes. And so on. So there's no basis for dialogue there. From the Russian point of view, they don't consider Zelensky any longer a legitimate leader of Ukraine because he's not elected. His mandate ran out last May, and he's ruling under martial law since then. So I think that if Ukraine wanted to make a deal, there would be a dialogue.
So everything connects to everything. And now we have the related question. If the United States was able to force Ukraine to go to talks or wanted to force Ukraine to go to talks, isn't there potential that they could do the same to Israel and Maybe we shouldn't be forcing anyone to do anything.
They're already doing the same to Israel. I mean, let's face it, they've been putting huge pressure on Israel. Peace negotiations with Hamas, don't go to war in Lebanon, on and on and on. So but the Israelis have held out against the circumstances are utterly different, of course. I think that the situation is that Israel's a major ally of the United States, vital to the peace in the entire region for the future, vital to America sustaining itself in the region, and we're treating it like a pariah.
Question. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, the United States objected to having Russian missiles very close to our border. What power should Russia be allowed to have over its neighboring states? What ability to enforce agreements that the neighbors make?
Are you talking about missile agreements on deployment of missiles?
Well, it could be missiles. Ukraine gave up its nuclear capability when it became an independent country.
Well,
So
never.
how much can Russia demand of the neighbors?
Well, let's make a few points. First of all, Ukraine never owned any nuclear weapons. They were owned by the Russians. They were in the possession of the Ukrainians because they were on Ukrainian territory. And the Ukrainians were persuaded that it wasn't a very good idea to hold on to them. They couldn't use them anyway because they didn't have the codes. But I think the biggest mistake, if you want, that we made and the Russians made and the Europeans made, everybody, was to give up the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement, which regulated to some degree the disposition of forces on both sides. Where they came in contact and provided for limiting the amount of missiles and nuclear weapons, that kind of thing. But the INF is dead. It was canceled by Trump. Now, the reason for cancellation was because the Chinese were coming up with the intermediate type of capabilities that we wanted to counter, but the treaty prevented us from doing that. So we canceled the treaty. Blamed it on the Russians. That was a mistake.
We said the Russians were cheating. Were they not cheating? I mean,
I'm
they cheat on everything.
sure they were cheating. We don't cheat.
I didn't say we don't, just saying
Okay.
that they
I
did.
mean, they were cheating, but that could have been negotiated, but it wasn't. For a while we complained, but we didn't really try to negotiate it. There were many things we could have done that if we really were serious about keeping the treaty. We didn't want the treaty. We wanted to get rid of it. So we did.
Okay, because the treaty was stymieing us on a different front.
I believe so.
Okay, now you've turned to the subject of American military capabilities. So can you talk to us about where we are here? How much of what we've given to Ukraine directly affects our military readiness? Have we replaced any of it? Are we talking about replacing it? Where are we? And the same relates, by the way, in some ways to Israel, because we're also supplying them with military equipment. Are we draining ourselves?
No, we're also draining stuff for Israel.
Yeah.
The first thing to think about is the arsenal that we have, the amount of weapons that we keep for our own military has been badly depleted from routine things like ammunition for howitzers, 155 millimeter howitzers, to smart weapons. All of them have been sent to Ukraine, so we have very little. Now they're trying to replace some of it. But the problem is it takes some years to manufacture these systems, and we're having significant problems in our industrial base supply chain and labor. Maybe you watched the Yankees on TV. I'm fixated on that. But anyway, if you look behind the home plate, you'll see a sign that says "Build submarines." because there are not enough workers to build our submarines. We're having a terrible problem recruiting the labor. We're having problems with the supply chain because a lot of the parts that we're using actually come from China or from Asia. And the other part is that, because of the nature of defense procurement, where you buy something, they make it for a few years, and then they stop making it, a lot of those plants close down. So to restart them takes time, and to train the labor force takes time. So the bottom line is that we're in short supply right now in many critical systems. And the more we plow into Ukraine, the more the short supply is. So it's not a happy situation.
So maybe what we could use to solve more than one problem at a time is a big push for jobs in the defense industry, which would raise our employment, raise our technology base, and do a lot of other things that we want done. And maybe we should think about whether we can go in that direction. What do you
I think
think?
that makes sense, a lot of sense. But it's not easy to recruit people to work in defense companies for a lot of reasons. First of all, it's episodic employment. You get a 2-year contract and then it goes away, you're out of a job. So that's not very attractive to especially highly skilled people. They want security. So that has to be fixed somehow. The second problem is that ideologically, a lot of people don't want to work making weapons. So you've got that problem. Thirdly, because the people have to be cleared, they have to be, they have to be okay to work in these industries. Selecting people is very hard. It's hard work. Vetting them is hard. And a lot of people don't like that either. So they're trying. I mean, I'm not. Many of the companies, Lockheed, Raytheon, others, are certainly trying to recruit workers and to rebuild these assets, manufacturing assets, which have atrophied. But it's going to take time.
Okay, side note for me to the listeners. I do not want to hear about Philly fans, Nationals fans, Mets fans, just because Steve said he's a Yankees fan. We try to stay non-political here. Our motto is policy, not politics, also not sports. Another question has come up. Now, the question here that someone sent to us says, do you think that if the Ukraine war ended, we could disrupt the Russian-Chinese alliance? We have another question in the pot that says, can you talk about what has happened to Russia and Iran since the war? So we're looking now at Russia, Iran, China. Is that a new axis? North Korea, axis of unpleasant people? What's going on?
Well, it's definitely unpleasant. No doubt. There's no doubt about that. So the first part of the question about Russia and China, the sanctions have driven the Russians into the arms of the Chinese because now have no pro their money has been impounded in Europe and the United States. They can't do business in the West. Their ability to sell to the West, like natural gas, has been damaged seriously. The destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline is a great example of stupidity. So we have excluded Russia so much that we've driven them the other way. Whether they'll turn and come back again, I kind of doubt it. I mean, it would have to, first, the sanctions would have to be lifted. It would have to be a really Herculean effort to try and re-engage them with Western companies, but I don't think they'll take the chance now. There are many Western companies in Russia, car companies, manufacturing, have left Russia. They're out. And they've been replaced by Chinese.
Which may or may not be a good thing for the rest of us. So, but what you're saying though is that this thing that looks like an axis of unpleasant countries is probably a long-term proposition. And one of the reasons I raise that is because Iran is selling Russia drones. And that's a kind of battle testing of Iranian drones, which the Iranians may want for other purposes, like Middle Eastern purposes. How concerned do we have to be that even if Russia doesn't expand the war beyond Ukraine, the things that people learn are going to be used in other parts of the world?
Well, they will be. I mean,
Right.
as soon as you put something out there, people have to deal with or shoot at or whatever it is, it changes the game. I think the situation with Iran has turned around in a certain way. Not a good way, but a certain way. The Iranians provided the drones to the Russians. Most of that has now been transferred to Russia as Russians manufacturing their own, some with Iranian designs that have been improved on. But large scale transfers from Iran to Russia not happening, I don't believe. The North Koreans provided some ammunition that turned out to be crap. So I don't think that was very helpful. The bigger problem is that now the Russians are starting to put things into Iran. Air defenses, pretty soon Su-35s are going to show up in Iran. And that makes the Iranians really more dangerous. So I think, and there's some allegations, and I don't know that they're true, that the Russians may have helped or may be helping them on their nuclear program. So the long-term implications of this are very bad. And there it is. I don't know what to tell you other than there it is.
Oh, that's not very optimistic. We're going to get to my optimistic point later
Okay.
in this conversation because we can't leave on a down note, but that is the biggest down note we've had in weeks. So when the war started, there was this monster Russian move into Ukraine, and then there was a Ukrainian move, and then that, and all this stuff sort of goes to the grinding parts of a war. So we've had someone write into us and ask, where is the momentum in the war right now? We know historically Russia can grind a long time in a war. If you look at World War II, they do that. Where's the momentum? And what's your thought about whether Ukraine can stand this for any length of time, even without support?
Well, the experts are a little bit divided on this question, including me. But basically, the Russians are starting to win against major strongholds that the Ukrainians have in Donbass, which is the critical area where the most of the fighting is taking place. Beyond that, it doesn't look to me, and this is my judgment, that the Ukrainians have very much in the way of defenses, which means if the Russians are successful in these battles in various important towns like Chasiv Yar being one of them, then what you're going to see is a rush to the Dnieper River by the Russian army. And that's very, very dangerous. And whether the Ukrainians have enough troops left and capabilities left, and the willpower is an open question. I think the war is reaching an end.
So we'll reach the point where a stalemate, or we'll reach the point where Russia ends up in Kiev.
No, the war is reaching an end means that the Russians are winning. And that the Ukrainians are going to either sue for peace or find their government replaced by a pro-Russian government.
Ukrainian pro-Russian government, perhaps.
Yeah,
So
on
that
the
it looks
paper.
tolerable to the
Yeah,
West.
well, that's a Russian trick. They've done it in many places.
Okay, so we have a fairly long question here. Somebody writes in, and I'll just go to the heart of it. Russia's invasion was 2014, not 2022. And for those who don't remember, that's when Russia took Crimea. And then he goes on to say, every issue to be addressed in a negotiated settlement was agreed to decades ago in a multitude of bilateral and international agreements. If the West, with more than half the global economy, can't deal with Russia, that has the economy of New York City, he says. That's an insult to New York City. What can we expect the United States to do with China? So there are two questions here. First of all, yes, it's true. Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014. And part of what Zelensky has said to the US and to Congress was that that has to be reversed, as well as the 2022 invasion. But yeah, those issues were already addressed. So if we went from agreements where those issues were addressed to a really, really destructive physical war on the battlefield, how did that happen? What happened to the agreement?
I don't know what agreement you're referring to.
The Minsk Agreement, the agreements.
Well, Minsk, yeah, that's okay. Minsk was a, didn't address Crimea.
No, but the agreements before, when Ukraine became an independent country, and they made the agreement on the nuclear weapons, and they made various agreements, and Ukraine was supposed to have real borders, like other countries are supposed to have real borders.
Okay, yeah.
The violation started in 2014 with the first Russian invasion of Ukraine.
There's a lot more to it than that,
Give us the short
but
form. Yeah, we want to go
I
there.
but I would agree that the Russians didn't observe the agreements, and neither did the Ukrainians. So the bottom line was, whether you want to say Crimea or Donbass or whatever, the fact is that neither side was content with any deal. The
So,
Minsk agreements, by the way, were a pretty good deal. But really, the Ukrainians trashed
how did they, what did they do? How did the Ukrainians
that. They
violate?
refused to abide by the critical provisions that had to do with making Donbass an autonomous area that would be still under the Ukrainian constitution and subject to Ukrainian law. They rejected that because they didn't want it to be autonomous. One of the problems in Ukraine, which everybody forgets, is there's a large Russian-speaking population that covers Crimea, that covers parts of the southern, along the Sea of Azov, and then up through the Donbass, up through there. There were two kind of arguments going on. But the one of them was about these Russian population and what degree of autonomy they would have. The Russians were slow to catch on to the fact that the West was planning not only to put Ukraine into the EU, which is still pending, but something that the Russians objected to because they wanted it in their orbit. But they really began to realize that they were going to end up with NATO in Ukraine after 2008, and that they considered that a threat to Russian security. Ukraine is right on the Russian border and not very far from Moscow, actually, from the western border of eastern border of Ukraine. I don't know
So,
if that answers your
well,
question,
it
but
does. It goes, I mean, it goes partly to the next question that we're going to get to in a second. It goes to the fact that things happened before 2022, and we have a tendency to look only at the most recent things. And so people say, oh, look, Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, but in fact, they invaded it before. And even before that, there were
yeah, but so did
negotiations.
NATO. I mean, keep in mind that the NATO was training the Ukrainian troops and supplying the intelligence to the Ukraine, all kinds of stuff, probably as early as 2008. So the Russians weren't stupid. They saw all this. They're
So,
not justifying their invasion. That was wrong. But I think that you can see what caused their anxiety.
well, this goes along with the question that says, why do we believe, or why do I believe, because I wrote the invitation, that the issue is no longer in the headlines? It's not in the headlines. If you read the New York Times and you read the Washington Post, I try not to read either, but if you read them, Ukraine used to be front page and it's not front page anymore. However, the question that goes with this is it doesn't necessarily mean it's not a very important question, even if the media is not covering it. And we had several people ask whether this could devolve into a nuclear war or a broad European war, a European continental war.
Yeah.
So, what do you think?
Well, as I said at the beginning, we're reaching a danger point, because will the West accept a Russian win in Ukraine? Or will the West want to send in forces of some kind to fight in Ukraine? And can they do it? And what would they be? And where would it lead? And the general thought, because Putin has already said to NATO and to Washington very clearly that if you do that, he was talking mostly about bombing Russian territory. If you do that, we're at war. Simple as that. I'm at war with NATO. I'm going to take, going to attack. So he's just augmented his army by 150,000 new people. So the Russians are, can I say, they're watching very carefully what Washington does, especially Washington, because if there's any hint that we're going to send in forces, that the game changes and we will have a war in Europe. I don't think it's a war anybody wants.
Including the Russians.
No, they don't want it. Why would they?
But you raise an interesting point in the middle of this. The Russians just augmented their armed forces by how many people?
I believe 150,000, but I
Okay,
maybe more.
close enough. Close enough. You know, it's 150,000. It's a lot of people. 2 points. Ukraine can't do that. There is a finite number of Ukrainians. So it's always seemed to me that Washington's choices were only a couple of choices. One is we could supply money and equipment and let the Ukrainians fight to the last Ukrainian, okay? And at some point there will be a last Ukrainian. Or we could augment that with better weapons, which we've already done. We've upped what we've given them. Or third point, we could go do it ourselves. But we do not seem to have a military large enough, trained military, ready military, large enough to do that. The Russians have an endless stream of people that they can impress into their armed forces. So aren't we the ones at the we're behind the curve here? We can't do that, which
Well,
they can do.
yeah. I mean, if you're talking about warfare, expeditionary forces don't always do very well. Ask the British. They lost them in World War I and they lost them in World War II, Dunkirk, for example. So, yeah, I mean, anytime you're doing an expeditionary force, you're faced with huge logistics problems. We don't have the weapons right now. It's an inauspicious time to get into a conflict with Russia or anybody else for that matter.
And Europe doesn't have them either. I mean, if you talk about who is best equipped to go to war, I don't think we're great, but I suspect we are better than France or Germany or Italy. And don't you have to count on, you have to calculate with that.
Well, it was a great question of whether any European country would want to do it. I mean, maybe not. The Poles, when they're talking to the public, say, yeah, it would be tough. But when they're talking to each other, they're saying, no, we don't want that. So I think, look, the German army is zero. It's not meaningful. It's zero. The French army is not so bad, but the French are going to want to stay at home. They're not going to go send troops to Ukraine. I mean, French would say you're crazy. The Poles have a fairly nice sized army right now, but they have to defend Poland. And if you send your troops to Ukraine, what happens next?
Russia invades Poland
Yeah, well, that's
and the
happened
troops are down
before.
in Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not something anybody's really ready to have happen. And now you left out in your question the fourth alternative, which is to negotiate with the Russians. I think we can. I think we should. I don't think we're in a position to do otherwise. But I worry that Washington will not want to be defeated, will not want to lose face with its European clients, and that so it will do something foolish.
Okay, left field. Question. We're coming closer to the end of the program. So the left field questions come in, aside from several people who have taken the time to point out that they are in fact Yankees fans. Thank you very much, guys. Go Nats. Question about pagers and exploding cell phones
And more.
and more things are exploding today.
Yeah.
Can you tell us anything about this? What do you know about this?
Well, I know more or less what's been written. I mean, there was pretty certainly a cutout company that was set up, maybe in Hungary, but maybe elsewhere, but using the Hungarian company, a Hungarian company as a front, to sell. Pagers, to and walkie-talkies, and other stuff, to Hezbollah. And instead, they were manufactured somewhere with bombs put in them, explosives put inside. Very clever, brilliant, and it worked.
And it worked. And I don't, there are people in the United States, by the way, this is for the listener's benefit, not Steve's benefit, who are holding a medical fundraiser for Lebanon and a memorial service for a young man who died in Lebanon, who Hezbollah has a picture of on their website as one of their young fighters. We should be concerned about this, no? So, what does it mean? It was clearly a brilliant operation. It clearly goes to the question of can you take out the people you need to take out without enormous amounts of collateral damage? It seems to me it was a very good thing. Why is everybody so upset about this?
Because it's okay for Hezbollah to shoot rockets into Israel, but it's not okay for Israelis to kill Hezbollah.
That's it.
That's it. That's the bottom line.
That's it. See, I think that's a really important thing to say out loud. Because all the time that this administration has been yelling at Israel about too many civilian casualties and too much destruction and too much. So Israel goes to the absolute minimum, which is one pager per one terrorist, very little collateral damage. And I am sorry if there is any. I'm always sorry if there is collateral damage because some people don't deserve it, but some people do deserve it. I don't think you can get better than this. Do you think anyone
Well, the
can do better than
administration
this?
has a unique capability to embarrass itself on multiple fronts at multiple times. The incompetence, the lack of support of an ally, the attempt to align with Hezbollah and Hamas, and all the worst things in the world, the support of Iran is pretty disgusting.
So this loops us back to Ukraine. So in other countries like Ukraine, which definitely needs the United States, they need us. And Israel, which also needs us. I mean, I would wish that Israel was more independent, but it isn't. It is dependent in many ways on the United States. So when they see the United States telling Israel that perhaps the very best use of technology ever in the history of warfare is too much, too much. What happens to our other allies? What happens to the other people who need us? Do they start worrying even more than they used to?
Sure. Why wouldn't they? Because they'll get accused of some human rights violation or some other stupidity.
Which makes a perfect place to go to the last question that I always ask. I have trouble leaving the listeners with all the depressing stuff that you have put on the table. You have put enormous amounts of depressing stuff on the table, as do most of our speakers. I have to say, almost everybody is depressing. And therefore, I have a final question. If I asked you to leave us with a non-depressing note, if I asked you to leave us with an optimistic thought, do you have one? And if you do have one, can you share it with us?
Well, the most optimistic note I can think of is that it's time for us to pay attention to our allies in the Pacific and to wind down the Ukraine conflict. It's not helping us.
That would be then the optimistic part would be that we're thinking about that. Is our government contemplating this? Because otherwise, it's not optimistic.
I'm sure there are people who are writing down a list of things we can and can't do, contingencies of different kinds. I hope that peace negotiations in Ukraine are one of them, because the alternatives are not very good. And I know the administration is concerned about the Pacific, and the Pentagon is working hard to try and bolster that as much as it can.
So that's an optimistic note. We have guys who have recognized the extent of the problems in the Pacific
I think so.
and are starting to worry about that. There are people who want me to ask you about the next election, and I'm not going to do it. And I'm just going to point out to the 14 people who asked that. Our motto here is policy, not politics, and it's rude to ask a speaker who they're going to vote for. So with that, I would like to say, Steve Bryan, thank you very much for an enlightening, if depressing, presentation. We can't ignore Ukraine. As much as we'd like to be focused solely on the Middle East, as much as we'd like to, deal only in the threats to Israel, the threat in Ukraine, and threat to Europe and to the rest of the world can't be diminished and has to be dealt with. So thank you for bringing us that. We appreciate it, and I hope you'll come back again.
Thank you.